I've talked many times about practice as a way of inviting all our various self states to find the seat at the table. As a way of bringing together all the different parts of ourselves even though we have come to practice trying to privilege one or two of the calmer or more joyful self states at the expense of those that bear our vulnerability or sorrow or anger or anxiety. Following the work of Philip Bromberg, we've talked about how finding a place for all these self states, even when that means tolerating conflict, is the way that we become whole by ending dissociation. And usually we give our attention here to those different self states that we've invited to sit around the table. But today, I think what I want to do is turn our attention to the table and chairs themselves, not so much who we're inviting to sit in them, but what is the setting we create to which they're all invited. What are the table and chairs? Perhaps some of you grew up like I did in a certain kind of middle-class family where in the home there was a formal dining room, a formal living room. And that was kept very orderly and clean and neat, and no one ever went in there. It was almost entirely for display, except on holidays when out-of-town relatives would come over. Ordinarily, the family or the people in the neighborhood, when they came over, they'd all sit around the kitchen table, or they'd sit in the den and chairs in front of the TV set. And I thought of that in terms of what kind of situation or setting do we create ourselves for ourselves in practice. In a way, we've inherited this very elaborate formal set of furniture from our Asian ancestors. And yet it can be so perfect and sometimes exotic that it's more to be admired than actually used. In a way, I think of that as the way I try to put Western psychology to daily use. Whether it's Bromberg or Benjamin or Kohut, these are at least the tools of my everyday practice, as opposed to the sutras, which we make very little reference to, or even Dogen, which we sort of bring out on special occasions. what we're trying to do is fashion a usable sort of kitchen table where we can all sit around rather than set up something that is for show or display in the way that it uses what we've inherited from as antiques from previous generations. So part of what we're doing, and I think of this in terms of what we're going to do in a Sangha meeting later, is talk about what counts as a usable table and chair for us, both at our personal, individual, intrapsychic level, and at the level of Sangha, what brings us all together. So in one sense, this use of Zoom is a whole different set of table and chairs than anyone has ever brought out for company before. We've had to improvise. And it turns out the improvisation worked better than anybody expected. And part of what we have to think about is how we're going to incorporate that into our everyday usage. Sort of like saying, I guess we're going to put up all this patio furniture, have places for people to sit outside, since there are an awful lot of neighbors who seem to want to drop in on a regular basis. They won't all fit around our old kitchen table. See, I think we have a great deal of latitude in designing our table and chairs. And that however, is not something we should take for granted. What part of what we inherited was a model that said there really is one proper way to do this, one proper way to set up the furniture of Zen practice. And that was a model based on Japanese monasticism and how the living arrangements for the monks and the situation of the Zendo were all put together in a very certain way. So the monks would sleep and eat and live in the Zendo with very few possessions. And that having to live in that kind of close quarters, having to live with very few of any of what we would consider necessities, having very few possessions, having very few choices, living a very particular regimented, disciplined life. All of that was considered inseparable from the practice itself. It was the practice. The way you lived together was as important as sitting on the cushion. And a big part of what has transformed Zen in America has been the idea that, yes, how you live is a crucial part of your practice, but we can practice with whatever way we're living. We don't have to live in a certain kind of disciplined, formal way in order to practice with. See, one way to think about this issue from a philosophical perspective is to say that if we thought that there was such a thing as a single or universal human nature, we might imagine that there's a single technique for bringing about realization. And that because human nature was something that was timeless and unchanging, it was essentially the same now as it was in medieval Japan or India at the time of Buddha, that all across all those cultures and all those thousands of years, human nature was essentially the same. And maybe you would say, there's one way of practicing that could stay the same wherever it was and whoever it was practicing. But a contemporary picture now, we could say, wants to distinguish sort of almost the fantasy of a universal human nature from a complex, historically and culturally determined human situation, to use Sartre's language. And that situation keeps changing, keeps evolving. And it's a situation that we have to deal with, not some unchanging human nature. And so how we practice and what's going to bring about realization is going to change with our situation. And we have to figure out how it's best to function where we are now. And that gives us a great deal of latitude in how we design our tables and chairs. See, but if you really look at a lot of the classics of Zen literature, you can come across, you know, references to Buddha nature as if it meant the equivalent of a permanent human nature. As if it was this unchanging essence of who we are. But I think that's a misunderstanding of Buddha nature. It's a kind of category mistake. It's describing things at a very different level. If we just take as our touchstone the title of the Joan Stembo book that we're going to be reading, Impermanence is Buddha Nature. Impermanence, meaning constant change, is the opposite of having any kind of unchanging essential nature. And it's a fact about everything in the world, a fact about rocks and trees, not just about people. And that means Buddha nature is something closer to gravity than it is to what used to get called human nature. It's more a description of how the world works than a statement about people in particular. See, what we're dealing with, rather than this very general abstract idea of impermanence, which you could say is a feature of the physical universe, we're trying to deal with something closer to Aristotle's idea of eudaimonia, or flourishing. What does it take for a human life to flourish, to be happy, to develop its capacities? And Aristotle thought flourishing meant the development of particular virtues, And he named them as courage and moderation and discernment. And even though they developed within a particular cultural framework, he tended to think of them as universals. And now we would look at his overall framework and maybe say, yes, I agree that human happiness or flourishing is a byproduct of developing our individual virtues or capacities. But the ones we develop may be very different than the ones he talks about. He spoke of justice, but he didn't speak about mercy or compassion. We might have a very different set of virtues around which we organize our life and become a whole and functioning person. So I think what this means to me now is that we have both a great deal of latitude and a great deal of responsibility in the designing of the table and chairs. We're not here simply to replicate what was done in Japan. We can use that as a model to some extent, and to some extent when we create a zendo like the one we had in New York, we set up an altar and cushions, and there are ways a person could walk into that and see the Japanese template behind it. But now as we sit, brought together by Zoom, each sitting in their own room, in their own home, that Zendo model becomes more and more tenuous. We each may recreate a little piece of it at home. We have a little corner with our Zafu and Zavatan and maybe set up a home altar. But there's really no predetermined model for how we're going to do this. What I hope we're going to figure out is how to create an entirely new hybrid mode of practice. One that is in some sense decentered. We're going to, I hope, be able to soon reopen the Zendo in New York. And in some sense, it will be the center of practice, if I can start giving talks from there again, for instance. But in many important ways, I think the center of gravity of our practice has shifted. And I hope when we reopen, we can take account of that and figure out how to really engage with the fact that the majority of our Sangha now is spread out across the world, and just in terms of numbers, the center is no longer where it used to be. I think it's a exciting time, full of new possibility. But the temptation in a way will be to just revert to what we did before. And I think we need to do our best to respect what has gone before, but find a way to genuinely make it new for the coming year.